You're listening to 209 Radio on 103.5 FM, and this is So Far and Yet So Near. Hello there, and I'm Hannah Higginson.
And I am Derek Thorne, and this is the show that brings global issues to you. If there's anything happening in Cambridge with a global flavour, then we are there, or at least we try to be.
Today's theme on 209 Radio is voices, and coming up tonight we'll be hearing from a man who works to preserve endangered languages. He'll be telling us why it's important and how he helped to preserve an Aboriginal language from Australia.
Also tonight, the International Global Ceasefire Day, which has only been in existence for a few years, was the idea of one man, and he'll be speaking later on.
And we'll be counting down our top five unreported stories of 2005. Stay tuned. This is So Far and Yet So Near. Firstly, though, I would like to introduce our studio guest, Dina Ridge. She's been on 209 three times, so welcome back to the studio, Dina.
Yeah, thanks very much.
Now, Dina is a member of the Home Office's Independent Monitoring Board for Prisons. Dina, if you can start off by telling us a bit about what this role involves and how this gives inmates a voice.
I think we are a neutral body. We are appointed by the Home Office. And when we go in there, we don't only look after the inmates, we look after the officers as well, and we look after the premises as well. So our role is to inspect the premises to say everything is working all right and everything is, like, you know, user-friendly. And also we listen, we are a listening voice, listening ear, you know, for the officers and the inmates.
And you are a volunteer, are you? I mean, is this all volunteering work?
Oh, yeah, it's all volunteering, yeah. You get paid your travel expenses, obviously, but apart from that, you don't get paid for anything. So when you do it, I think you do it because your heart is in it. You want to really help. You want to make a difference.
Okay. Could you tell us a bit more about the work you do? What does the board do?
Once a month, they have like a board meeting where whoever is the governor of the prison comes as well. So we directly talk to the governor, and depending on the size of the prison, they will have so many number of IMBs, means independent monitoring board members. So, say, if it's about 600 mates or whatever, then we'll have 12 or 14 members. Then we take it in turns to go and inspect. So we will have like a rotor system. So if we are on a rotor system, there are certain statute and mandatory things which we have to do. So when we go, we have to inspect the kitchen. We have to go and talk to everybody who is in segregation unit to make sure that they are not suicidal or they are not being ignored. They are there isolated. So we have to make sure. Then we have to make a report in the book. And then we have to go and see the medical to see if everybody gets the medical treatment and whatnot. And if they have any problems or whatever, then we have to highlight it in our report. And apart from that, after we have done the mandatory bit, it's up to us to actually go and see whether we want to go in a certain wing. But we have a book in the office where we just tick. So the previous week we would know what was done. So in the book we can see where they happen, nobody has been. So we make sure. So all of the prison, as a result of it, gets monitored, you know, at one time or the other during the year.
And do you find that you get a good response from the inmates as a result of this service? Do you have a lot of contact with them yourself?
Yes, yeah, because I think when we go to the workshops where they're working, we actually go and talk to them. And when we go in the wings, if they are out, you know, say eating or whatever, we always go and talk to them. And also every Monday we used to have applications clinic, means if any inmate has any problem and he doesn't want to discuss it in front of everybody, then two of us will meet this inmate privately in a room and we'll listen to his complaint, whatever, and then we actually write to him whatever the complaint is and try to follow it up and solve it for him. And if we can't solve it, we seek help from the governor or, you know, their wing governor. Or if it's to do with the prison they are transferred from, then we go back to the prison they are transferred from and try to help them as much as possible.
So you allow the inmates to be heard and then act on that?
Oh, yes, yeah. We are, because I think sometimes because of confidentiality or whatever, they just want to have somebody neutral they can talk to and open up. Because sometimes they might say something and they might feel, oh, God, I wish I hadn't said this because this person might pick on me or something. But if somebody neutral like us are there, then, you know, they can open up. And if they have some problem, then it will solve the problem. And as a result of that, life will be better for everyone.
Uh-huh. You know? And you mentioned to us before the show that one of the exciting things you've been involved with in the prison is a diversity day. Could you tell us a little bit more about that day?
Oh, yes, yeah, I think it's very exciting. Once a year, I think a lot of inmates are given opportunity to say if they want to take part in the diversity event. And then they have to really plan, they have to budget to say how much money will go in the food, this, that, and other. Then they have the prison band which plays. And for me, my role is to bring people from the wider community in. So I take sometimes like the, you know, Bhangra drummers. I take the Chinese dancers and singers. I take Tai Chi master. And I do like presentations on Hinduism, and I show them how to put a sari on. And so it's very interactive, and also people from other faith come, like Baha'i and Brahma Kumaris. They talk about meditation and all sorts of different aspects of, you know, different religions.
And what's the response? How do the prisoners, the inmates, like it?
Oh, they just love it. I mean, they just don't stop talking. You know, they look at displays we have. They take real active interest in it. As a result of that, they learn. They go. It motivates them to go to the library and find out a bit more about whatever they've seen, you know, during the diversity. So it makes them, like, more informed. Mm. And for us, it's very good as well.
And what are the benefits for the people that go into the prison from the wider community? What's their reaction to the experience?
Because for me, I think like certain ethnic minorities, especially me, I think when I first went to the prison, you know, I had certain perception of how it would look. Because I come from a different sort of background. I come from Africa, so I had like a different sort of perception. And when I actually went in the prison, when I saw this diverse inmate, you know, population, I was quite surprised to see, wow, you know, it was like not intimidating, but it was like eye-opening, you know. So the people like in the community who come, they will change their perception about, you know. So, and also when they talk to them, they can actually feel how actually it is to be in a prison. Because sometimes people say, oh, it's like a holiday camp or whatever, you know. But sometimes when they see the cells, which are doubled up, and the space is so limited, there is no privacy, and sometimes you feel, wow, you know, if I was in this cell, I would get suffocated.
Mm. Could you finally just tell us a little bit about the diversity of the prison population as well? What's the diversity of that like?
Yeah, there are quite a lot of Asians. There are Afro-Caribbean people, lots of English, and
So it's a real mix.
A few Chinese as well. So, I mean, I've seen only the prison I'm talking about where I used to go, not all the prisons.
Okay. Yeah, yeah. And do you find that it increases, you know, dialogue between those different groups within the prison?
Oh, yes, because they learn from each other, because they have, like, you know, within the prison,
yeah,
they have certain events, you know, which are like regular events where they can share their, you know, ideas and everything. They have befriending group as well, where all the people go. So the wider community goes in on a regular basis, and all the inmates it's open for them to just go. So quite a few of them come and interact.
Excellent. Well, thank you very much for coming to talk to us about that. And nice to have you on the show, Dina Ridge.
Thanks ever so
thank
much.
Thank you. Thanks so much.
Now then, you're listening to So Far and Yet So Near on 209 Radio with Hannah Higginson and Derek Thorne. And don't forget, you can get in touch with us here on this show on email. It's sofar@209radio.co.uk.
Each year at Darwin College, they run a series of public lectures. The theme of this year's event is survival. On February the 3rd, Peter Austin from the School of Oriental and African Studies in London spoke about the survival of language. What better person could there be to interview for a show on voices? In the world today, there are 6,500 languages, but 96% of the world's population speak only 4% of these languages. This means that thousands of languages are being spoken by very small communities across the world. But what does this mean for their survival? Professor Austin told us more.
What we find is that the smaller languages are under threat. They're typically under pressure from a larger, more socially, economically, politically dominant neighbouring language. So kids are growing up abandoning their ancestral languages and switching to the bigger languages of wider communication.
Why does this matter? Why are you concerned by the extinction of language?
Well, every language in the world is unique. Every language is a particular way of talking about and thinking about and expressing the world. Each language is different in terms of the kinds of concepts that people talk about, the way that they think about things, the way that they express themselves. Language is an important carrier of culture and heritage. So people's songs, their histories, their mythology, their oral literature is expressed in the language. And when the language dies, the cultures and the expressions of that disappear with it as well. Another important aspect is that language is a marker of identity. We use language to express who we are, to differentiate ourselves from other people, and to group and link ourselves with people who are like us. So once people lose their language, they lose part of their identity, part of their understanding of who they are, where they come from, and how they are different and what they have that's special.
So what are you doing to counteract this extinction that's taking place?
There are a number of different projects that are working around the world. Some of those are internationally based projects that involve training researchers, collecting materials, documenting languages, archiving data so that it can be made available for people to use and to be kept for the future, combined together with grassroots activities that communities are developing and originating themselves. So throughout the world, we see many different groups who are concerned about the loss of their language and heritage and culture, who want to support them, to maintain them, to work out ways to teach them to children, to develop, for example, language nests where older speakers, fluent speakers, are brought together with the young children in a preschool environment so that the children will grow up speaking their heritage language as well as the languages of wider communication that they need. So they will become a generation of bilinguals who are able to speak, or multilinguals who are able to speak multiple languages.
Now, you mentioned in the lecture one particular community that you've been involved with a lot in Australia. Can you tell us a little bit about that community and what's happened there?
Well, the Gamilaroi community live in the northwestern part of the state of New South Wales in Australia. And up until the 1850s or so, Gamilaroi was the first language spoken by the thousands of people who belonged to that group over quite a large area. When the settlers arrived, they forced people off the land. They shot and killed and poisoned them and took them and made them live on reserves and reservations where only English was spoken. Their children were taken away and put into boarding schools where, again, only English was allowed. By the 1950s, 100 years later, Gamilaroi continued to be used, but only as a private language between older Gamilaroi people. I started working on this language in 1972, and we worked together, we collected material, we recorded vocabulary, words, expressions, but that was kind of it. In the 1970s in Australia, Aboriginal people were the underclass, and at that time, there simply wasn't the energy or the money or the ability to do anything in terms of supporting or sponsoring the language and culture. But all that changed about 15 years later when Australia started to think about itself as a country. With the bicentennial of the country, the nation started to consider how it had come into being, how it had taken what it had taken from the ancestral people who lived in Australia before the arrival of European settlers. And the political atmosphere changed. The Prime Minister stood up and admitted that the languages and cultures had been destroyed by whites and that there was a responsibility there. So I, at that point, worked together with some colleagues who were IT specialists, and with the local community, we developed a dictionary for the language. We developed an internet version of the dictionary. So this was one of the very first internet-based bilingual dictionaries. And they started a grassroots program to bring together the people who knew something about the language and the culture, to lobby the government to try and get the language recognized, introduced into schools. And eventually, in the late 90s, this was achieved. And Gamilaroi is now taught in primary schools in this area in Australia. There's a rock band that sings music in Gamilaroi. There are kids who sing songs at school in Gamilaroi. And the compositions and writing, the children are using this as part of their learning process. So what we've seen is a complete turnaround. A language that looked like it was going to be totally disappeared and gone has seen a complete change and a revitalization, with some potential for that to continue into the future.
That's Peter Austin from the School of Oriental and African Studies in London. And if you'd like to find out more about the Endangered Languages Project and even get involved, you can go to www.hrelp.org.
Did you know that the 21st of September is not only the autumn equinox? It is also fixed in the calendar as the International Day of Peace and Non-Violence. This day has, in fact, only been in existence since 2001, and it came about because one man, the filmmaker Jeremy Gilley, working together with the organisation Peace One Day, campaigned relentlessly to make it happen. Jeremy made a film about his rather arduous campaign, which is called Peace One Day, and he was in Cambridge recently as part of the university's One World Week to show the film and answer questions. But before all that, he was good enough to talk to me about the difficulties he had during his campaign and how anyone can get involved with the day, and firstly, how he conceived the idea.
Effectively, I was very concerned about the state of the world, as we all are growing up. I was asking questions, you know, is humankind fundamentally evil? Is the destruction of the world inevitable? You know, should I have children? Is that a sensible thing to do? And at that time, I was reading that media had a real responsibility in terms of being responsible with its output. And I thought, well, hang on a minute, I'm a filmmaker. I was an actor for many years with the Royal Shakespeare Company and other various entities. And I thought, well, maybe I could use film to try and make a difference in some way. And then I was thinking of the issues of peace. I was thinking about where's the starting point for peace. And so I decided, well, maybe I can make a film that tries to create and document the establishment of the first ever ceasefire, non-violence day, voted by every head of state in the world. The first ever World Peace Day. Thinking, it's bound to fail. You know, I mean, you know, I've got a D in pottery, I didn't go to university, I was an actor from the age of 12, so, you know, I didn't think it would work. But I knew that if I tried, no matter what the result, it would make a profound statement about how unwilling or willing we are to unite. You see, I could answer some of the questions that I had going on for myself by trying to establish something.
Could I just ask you a bit more about your background? You mentioned a D in pottery and so on. I mean, how hard was it then to try and really get involved in this field of international relations and to really get to meet all of these important people that you did meet?
Well, it was difficult. I mean, it was a case of, you know, I was a filmmaker, so I had a camera running the whole time. And the truth was, if we want to live in a united world, we're going to need a starting point for that process to begin. So very quickly, I realized that this idea was a good one. And as I traveled the world, visiting many areas of conflict, so I got a real sense of what conflict was truly all about, you know, I started to realize that there were lots of practical benefits. You know, if a ceasefire can be established, obviously lives are saved. But if a ceasefire can be established, then immunizations can occur, aid can be moved. You know, it's a non-violence day as much as it is a ceasefire day. So domestic violence, bullying, community violence, workplace violence, you know, all of these things come into play. So the day of ceasefire and non-violence, whoever you are, you have a part to play in this.
Could I ask you to give me kind of a flavour, if you like, of some of the situations and so on that you found yourself in during the making of film? For example, you know, what kind of places did you go to and some of the situations you ended up in?
Well, I found myself in completely unique situations to me, of course. You know, being in a room with the Dalai Lama or indeed with Kofi Annan or anybody else of, you know, with that amount sort of years of experience, you know, the top of their field is an extraordinary situation. But I think the most profound moments, you know, on a journey that, like, on when you've been on a journey like I've been on, is when you're with people who have nothing, who are dying. You know, and I mean, they're really, of course, that completely. I mean, it sounds like a cliche, but it is absolutely the thing that changes your life. You know, to be in Somalia, you know, with hundreds of, you know, thousands of displaced people, you know, who have no food, who have no medicine, you know, is life changing. And you know, I feel very sort of grateful and honoured to have gone on the journey that I've gone on.
How much of a challenge was it to get the world's media to take notice of this day?
It was impossible, absolutely impossible, to get the world's media to take notice in the early days. You know, once the film came out, it made a massive difference. But yeah, I mean, you know, to get people to write about the fact that every head of state in the world had just created the first ever day of peace with a fixed calendar date, the first ever ceasefire non-violence day, very few people wrote about it, and that's bizarre. I didn't understand why that was going on.
What is your progress now with the world? Peace Day, how prevalent is it around the world?
We've seen activity happen in about 100 countries involving thousands and thousands of people. It's growing, it's working. I'm now making a second film because I now want to document the first ever ceasefire occurring in a particular conflict zone so that, you know, an immunization process or aid can be moved. So I'm engaged in another film. I'm also fascinated by the role that corporations have to play in a united world, because I think that they have an immense amount of power, obviously, you know, with their workforce and their money and their products, etc. And I really want to see the corporate world step up to the mark as much as I want to see the individuals embrace the day that are listening to your programme.
What's your message to people listening to this? I mean, what can they do to try and get involved in making the world more peaceful and so on?
Whatever sector of society you are working in, whether it's government, intergovernment, non-government, whatever it is, we can all play a part. Even if it's, you know, having a moment of silence in our room, whether it's, you know, making up with a friend, whether it's, you know, doing something in the university or doing something in the school or the workplace or whatever, we can all make an important contribution. And really, you know, that's as simple as acknowledging the day. If people can come to our website, peaceoneday.org, and log your commitment saying what it is you are going to do, that is how we are able to show the process of this day becoming more and more aware.
That was Jeremy Gilley, the director and producer of the film Peace One Day. And I'll just mention the website again, which is peaceoneday, all one word, .org, where you can find out about ways to take part in the World Peace Day and where you can also get a copy of the film.
You're listening to So Far and Yet So Near on 209 Radio, currently on 103.5 FM. Still to come are top five underreported stories of 2005. But first, this year, Cambridge County Council marked Holocaust Memorial Day on Thursday the 26th of January in a civil ceremony held at the Guildhall. The theme of this year's event was One Person Can Make a Difference. The event was an inspirational mix of music and testimony, which reflected on the Holocaust and other genocides, while also looking forward to the future. I spoke to Mike Levy, an organiser of the event and producer of Holocaust materials for schools, about the memorial.
Tonight's event was the Cambridge City's response to the National Holocaust Memorial Day. This is a day that happens every year, round about 26th or the 27th of January, to commemorate victims of the Holocaust in the Second World War and other genocides.
You mentioned schools already and there were lots of children involved. Can you tell us why did you choose to include so many children?
Well, we had over 90 children this year, actually, from three local primary schools, St Luke's, Arbury and Park Street, and it was wonderful to have them here. The reason why we had them was because the message of National Holocaust Day is both to look back at the terrible things that happened during the Holocaust, but also, more importantly in some ways, to learn about the future and to ensure that those horrible things don't happen again. And of course, as children are our future, what better message than to come from their mouths?
One of the best things about the ceremony definitely was the involvement of children. I spoke to Leslie Ford, Expressive Arts Coordinator for Arbury Primary School, about her school got involved.
Well, it was a couple of years ago, Rowena Whitehead, who was also singing here this evening, wanted some children to be involved because they are the hope for the future. That's what people like to see. It's not just about being here and being sombre and sad. It's about hope for the future. So we got involved singing with Rowena, and we've been here for 3 years now. And this year, it so happened that the theme being everything making a difference, one person making a difference, we sing a song called A Drop in the Ocean, which is exactly about that, so it fitted rather well.
Perfect. And can you tell me, did the kids enjoy it? What was their reaction to being involved?
Well, Mike and Jenny came into school and did some work with the children about the Holocaust and the kinder transport, especially, that being relevant to Cambridge, because so many children came here. and they wrote some poetry, which was great. And they were really responsive and really gripped, especially on one day they brought Eva, who was a Holocaust survivor, to talk to the children, and they were absolutely spellbound by that. Horrified, but spellbound. They couldn't quite believe it. So it's been a real good thing for year sixes at school.
And why do you think it's so important to engage children with these issues?
I think it's something that's difficult to teach, and it's something that many teachers, especially in primary school, shy away from. We often teach about the Second World War, but we end up eating jam sandwiches and singing White Cliffs of Dover, and this is much more real. And it's really important that children know that horrible things go on in the world and that they can have a small part in stopping them happening.
This is So Far and Yet So Near on the temporary restricted service licence on 209 Radio. And if you like what you're hearing here on this show, then why not tune in to the other two shows that we've got coming up this week. On Tuesday at 6, you can hear an interfaith discussion all about love. And also on Wednesday at 6:15, another show of features and interviews, including us playing live on air a new board game made in Cambridge called War on Terror. So tune in for that.
Forgotten Children International is one of the world's largest non-governmental organisations working with children with disabilities in the developing world, a group that often have very little voice. The aim of the organisation is to provide medical aid and resources to children so that they can overcome and cope with their disability and become active and valued members of their community. As part of One World Week, Beverly Nixon, regional fundraiser, gave a talk about the organisation. We caught up with her afterwards, and she started off by telling us about the organisation's work.
We're an international charity, and we work in the developing world in over 100 different countries, and we specifically work with children who are disabled or blind, giving them the medical treatment they need or the long-term care that they need.
And is this a big problem in the developing world?
It's a terrible problem. It's just so huge. There's so many different varieties of disabilities. We work a lot with children who have various forms of blindness. It's just making them aware of the help that's available to them, just getting them to the hospitals, as well as just giving them the treatments. There's so many children still to be reached.
So are the treatments actually quite simple that the children can receive for things like blindness?
Relatively simple, yes. So for a cataract operation for a child, it takes about 15 minutes to have the operation. If they're a small baby, they can just have the cataract just washed out, or there's just a simple operation if they're slightly older, and that costs just £80 to give them that. So, I mean, treatment is out there, it's relatively simple, and it's also affordable for us over here. But yeah, it's just reaching them and providing it for them over there in their situations.
And is there also a big problem with stigma in the developing world connected to disability?
Yes, there's a lot of traditions and suspicions, specifically in the more traditional communities, so the smaller villages in some of these developing countries. There's a lot of stigma for children. Say, if they have a disability, they'll see it as a punishment of some sort, or they'll see it as punishment for some crime that they've committed. So, yes, the children who are disabled, who become disabled, are often isolated from their community, isolated from their school friends, and do not necessarily receive some of the help or the care that they need because of this rejection.
The charity itself is called Forgotten Children. You talked a little bit about those forgotten children. Can you give us an example of that?
Yes, there's one story in particular that really captures why we are called Forgotten Children, and it's the story of a little boy called Alan. And Alan lives in Papua New Guinea, and he was visited by a couple of our co-workers. When they reached the village where he lives and they reached his hut, instead of being invited into the hut, as is the usual way, they were instead directed around to the back of the hut, and they came to a stone building. As they entered this building, it was completely dark inside. They couldn't see anything. And Alan's father entered the building. He bent down and he picked something up from the floor. It wasn't until they got outside that they realized that what he was carrying was a young boy. It was Alan. He has cerebral palsy, and this had basically made half of his body completely tight. And just because of a lack of education on how to treat those with disabilities, and just a lack of finances to be able to give him the medical help that he needed, Alan had just been put in this stone building. He'd been separated from the family, and he'd just been left there for years just to exist, basically, alone and just existing. So we've provided Alan with a small chair, which just gives him support, and it enables him to enter the family home and just take part in family life again. And we've offered them some sort of education about his disability as well, so they realise how to help him and where it comes from and what they can do. He's just one of many children who, because of disabilities, get forgotten or abandoned or just pushed to the side simply because of lack of education or means to help these children.
So if people want to get involved with your charity or help out, what can they do?
We are based in Cambridge, so there's various forms of fundraising ideas. If you get in touch with the office, then, as I said, if you get in touch with me, then that will be not a problem. Various different things, so pizza and pudding evenings if you're a student, or various different forms of fundraising. Or we're also trying to get students to be able to go abroad as well, to kind of work in the communities to reach some of these people who are disabled. We're working on that at the moment.
That was Beverly Nixon from Forgotten Children International, who are based locally. And if you want to find out more, you can go along to their website at www.forgotten-children.org.uk.
Now then, with today's theme of voices, we here on So Far and Yet So Near thought it might be appropriate to talk about some of the global stories of the last year that you may not have heard much about, or perhaps not anything about. So here it is, a quick run-through of our top five unreported global stories of 2005. And beginning with number five, the civil war in the north of Uganda, which involves the Lord's Resistance Army fighting government forces. The war has been going on for 19 years, and perhaps one of the most horrific parts of the conflict is the recruitment of child soldiers by the insurgents. And yet this rarely, if ever, makes it onto our news agenda.
At number four, we'd like to mention the political violence in Colombia, which has been taking place in some parts of the country for over 50 years. The right-wing government has attempted to crush the paramilitary group, but this has fueled the conflict even more, as has the drugs industry.
At number three, renewed fighting between the Congolese army and the Mai Mai rebels has caused the displacement of tens of thousands of people throughout one of the country's provinces in southeastern Democratic Republic of Congo. War has been going on for more than a decade, and despite an official ceasefire in 2003, the fighting does continue.
At number two, continued violence in the capital of Haiti, Port-au-Prince, which has been going on since 2004, where the former president Jean-Bertrand Aristide was ousted in an armed rebellion. Hundreds of people have been killed, hundreds more have been kidnapped, and the UN is struggling to cope with the violence.
And at number one, let's have a reality check. Do you notice anything about the stories we've just read out? Is there a common theme? It is, of course, doom and disaster. Yes, it seems that any news that we do receive from the developing world, however unlikely we are to get it, is unfailingly negative. So at number one, we've decided to go against the grain and choose a more positive story, because they are out there. And it is this. In Zimbabwe, a study published this week found that the prevalence of HIV/AIDS has dropped in a region in the east of the country. The hope is that this is due to a change in sexual behaviour, and that perhaps the rest of the country will follow suit. This is actually the first reported drop in southern Africa, and is particularly impressive because they've looked at young age groups and found the HIV rate dropping by large amounts. For example, in women between 15 and 24, it's dropped by almost half. We do, of course, have to raise a note of caution here, which is that there are many reasons why an HIV rate can drop. For example, migration of people or deaths from the disease itself. But this is still a positive result and does give everyone a bit of hope that we are starting to turn the tide against HIV. And with that, that's all from this, the first ever FM broadcast of So Far and Yet So Near.